Good morning and welcome to the Counselor's Cafe, where we focus on the care and feeding of the mind, the psyche, the spirit, whatever it is that makes us human, conscious of self, capable of change, and free to make choices. A little psychology, a little philosophy, and maybe a little bit of something else. This morning, we are continuing a conversation with our host on Tuesdays, host of Touchstones, Paul Nagy. Last week we were talking about affect, imagery, and consciousness, and today we're going to be talking about the psychology of the Tarot, and perhaps other pre-Freudian ways of trying to understand the human experience. But before that, I want to invite you to join in the discussion with any questions or comments you may have by calling 929-9601. Get involved. If you can't call right now, you can always get in touch later by emailing counselorscafe@nc.rr.com or by writing to Counselor Box 6, 200 West Weaver Street, Carborough, 27510. Let me know what it is you'd like to talk about or you'd like us to talk about. And while I'm talking about getting in touch, check out our website, www.communityradio.coop. Take our listener survey, click on the West End Report to find out how you can give us your news and get it on the air. Just look around the whole website and find out what fascinating shows we've got on. We have a very broad variety of shows that represent our multifaceted community. And we, of course, are all listener-supported, all-volunteer radio. There we go.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks. So today, if I remember right, last time we enthused about affect, imagery, consciousness, mm-hmm. and I did leave those two big fat volumes with you, and I wonder if you at all cracked open them and looked through them at all.
I have them open. I did check the section that I want to read, which is why I took the books home, and that's interest and excitement.
Right.
And I particularly wanted to read what he had to say about that because it's as a counselor working with people, particularly people who are transitioning.
Yeah, you want to get them excited about the movements.
Yes.
Yeah, it's engaging their motives.
Because
self empowerment. Yeah,
exactly. Even with youngsters in the past, I remember one of the saddest things was talking with someone, a young woman who was only 16 or so, and life had already gotten her to the point where she felt there was no point in trying.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things he says about, you know, stimulus, mm-hmm. affect, response, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And he put the affect in there, and of course, mm-hmm. So many of the ways, especially the ways that he identified the affect axes or mm-hmm, whatever you mm-hmm. want to call them, were, as you noted, were negative or could very
yes.
easily
yes.
be the kinds of feelings or responses that would put you off track. In
mm-hmm.
other words, wouldn't engage you to be enthusiastic or
right.
to be active or to be engaged, but rather would
mm-hmm.
be, things. I had this morning, I had a dream, which actually wasn't a dream so much as a waking a memory. It was a real memory.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was is I grew up in San Francisco
mm-hmm.
and was from a very early age, you know, like from 12 or 13 years of age, which is pretty young for this kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
I became very interested in the beatniks.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I particularly liked Allen Ginsberg's
mm-hmm.
Howl, which was the siren song of the beatniks.
Right.
And over the years, I had seen Alan, and I actually knew people who knew him,
mm-hmm.
but I never was, I'm actually a shy person. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't know it that I'm broadcasting myself on the radio, but I'm actually extremely shy and don't necessarily put myself out there mm-hmm. socially. So, you know, the few times I had seen him were always, and I was always, there was always the other person who was, you know, who knew Ginsberg or so forth and so on.
Right.
And at most, I was just sort of standing in the shadows. And therefore, I never engaged him directly in any kinds of conversation. Well, it so happened that one time when another friend of mine who was also part of this generation, though he wasn't identified for his own reasons with the Beats himself, mm-hmm. though he was exactly the same generation as they were,
mm-hmm.
Philip LaMattia was a surrealist poet. And he and I were actually quite good friends and had, mm-hmm. And we really had a friendship, a
right.
conversational friendship. And this is, and Ginsberg comes up to LaMattia and wants to introduce these poets. And so... Uh-huh. It was this thing, and so I said to Alan, I said, oh, nice to see you again.
Uh-huh.
And he's looked at me, and he shamed me. He says, I don't know who you are. He says, I hate people like you who are pretenders. And he went and he just ragged up and down.
Whoa.
And on, right? You know, telling me how he didn't know who I was, and I was presuming this familiarity and all this uh-huh. other stuff. You know, and I didn't say anything.
Right,
I was
right.
abashed. I was uh-huh. humiliated. And that uh-huh. was what I was feeling this morning. I was feeling, I guess, somewhat delayed by a decade uh-huh. or more. 20-year delay decade.
Right.
It was about, that was almost, not quite 20 years ago this
uh-huh.
happened. You know, and I'm thinking, you know, and, you know, and LaMattia, who knew me, you know, and knew the context. He knew that wasn't, that I had obviously
right.
Run into, because I've been around this milieu for
right.
for 25 years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I had bumped into him. But of course, in the issue of things, well, this is a real interesting thing. I think it was in a response to a show that was on NPR a few weeks ago, last week, about uh-huh. the library exhibit,
uh-huh.
in which they said that the way you were a beatnik was whether you were a friend of Allen Ginsberg or not.
Oh, really?
You know, it was Allen Ginsberg's network of friends
uh-huh.
And writers. And so I thought to myself, well, I guess I'm not on the inner circle. I was, you know, not only was I not a friend of Allen Ginsberg, you know, but I was, you know, very explicitly castigated as being a poseur.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And, you know, and I just remember the...
So this was part of the awaking memory this
yes,
morning?
Yes, it was a strong memory. So obvious. I mean, yeah. So the affect of... or the feelings of humiliation.
Right.
So I thought to myself, you know, so I always thought, I said, it was really a shame, because I said, you know, over the years, you know, when I was a young man, when I was an adolescent and I was reading Hal, I saw it as a, you know, as this clarion call to, mm-hmm. you know, to seeing a vision of America with, you know, in which the outcasts and the marginals were given voice
right,
and then
right.
and redeemed. And from that, as I got to know Ginsberg more, I saw himself as more as a really self-serving, mm-hmm. incredibly egotistical guy,
mm-hmm.
who was on a lot of bandwagons that were wagons that I myself got on at one time or another,
uh-huh.
though we weren't necessarily on them at the same time. You know, so for instance, I was deeply involved with esoteric tantric Buddhism,
uh-huh.
and who do I know who's interesting and who's into this? But Allen Ginsberg, you
uh-huh.
know. But as I said, we never particularly crossed paths
right.
conversationally. The so in some ways, you know, it. But what was? But I also knew that the guy was, you know, was incredibly, you know, and it was judgmental that way.
Yeah.
I mean, that
yeah.
was, that's what comes through in his poetry. It was, there was this, you know, this sort of rank prophetic. It's
mm-hmm.
a prophetic call,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's saying, you know, I can see what's right and wrong, and I can say this or that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And of course, in some cases, you know, you can be wrong,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and of course, and as we know from the book last time, humiliation
mm-hmm.
is one of the, you know, and the shame humiliation complex is
right.
one of the ones that gets used way too much, according mm-hmm. to Tom Berg.
Right.
Not Tom Berg.
Tompkins.
Tom Berg is another writer who deals with Taro, but mm-hmm. some other context. But today,
Yes. Today we're talking about...
Hopefully I will not humiliate myself too much more.
I promise not to castigate you. Or anything.
Right. Well, if I'm being a posor, I guess if I'm a posor today, I'm a posor as a tarot reader.
Well, yeah. I think, you know, the you were recently to a conference.
Yeah.
In
New
York,
the
right?
Reader Studio. Yeah. Uh-huh. And for those of you who are interested, we actually had a show about the Reader Studio, Touchstones,
Okay.
in which Marie White, who's a tarot artist, and I talked about it after a couple of days after it was over.
Is that available on the web yet?
Yeah, it's okay. Available through the Touchstones archives,
okay.
which is at wordtrade.com.
Why don't we just start with a little, very brief.
What is tarot?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. What is tarot, in case there's anybody
All right,
out
well,
there
tarot is a deck of cards, and it has some relationship to the normal deck of cards.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same as a normal deck of cards, except the court cards, that's the Jack, King, and Queen, there's a fourth pursuit, so there's four extra court cards. In that case, it's usually considered princess, prince, queen, and king, or some variation of that, page, knight. But usually in that letter. But the way it's broken down there.
And they have quite a long history.
Well, yeah, the technology of cards is such that they really only become available as something that's a mass marketed type thing about... and I'm really lousy with dates. Well, let's say 1450.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, maybe 1350 are the earliest examples. Mm-hmm. So that's Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
Italy. That are the original examples of playing cards, not tarot yet. We'll talk about tarot in a little bit. come from Persia.
Mm-hmm.
So the Arabic influence, particularly Persian, you know, mm-hmm. where the wands are actually polo sticks, you know, they're playing polo,
right?
And the swords are swords, and the but the wands classically were polo,
and the pentacles are coins, or
those I think so, yeah, or the, yeah. Yeah, and there's also I suppose the pinnacles being acorns in the Swiss tradition. So these attributions change. And, of course, the pinnacles are diamonds in a regular deck of cards.
Right. So which came first, regular deck of cards or the...
Regular deck of cards
deck
came
of cards.
First. Uh-huh. And then what it was is that they developed a trumps.
Uh-huh.
Now,
before the printing press, there weren't too many people who had cards to start with.
Well, that's true. Anyway. And there are examples... Of a Renaissance decks that are almost some of which are complete that include the trumps. The trumps are normally 22 cards, 21 of which are numbered and one the fool card not numbered.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a traditional order and a traditional cast of characters now, which is pretty well established and was actually quite early on. There wasn't a lot of variation. There's some variation, but not a lot. And the thing that's interesting about the trumps is that where do these characters come from and how do they come from? And one of the best and relatively novel, it's a relatively recent theory, and it is a theory, is that the trumps come from the triumphs, the circus or the fair day processions. The classic one being the Day of the Fool, in which supposedly that's the day, sort of like the Saturnalia, in which everybody who's in power goes out of power, and you have all the beggars rule. You know, so instead of the minister, the emperor being the ruler, the fool is the ruler. And then following the fool, you have the high priestess, or you know, because obviously, or in the earlier decks, it was the papess, you know, the pope,
right,
the woman pope.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, some people think, oh, that's based on the great medieval myth of Pope Joan. But no, unfortunately, it's not. and so, but you have this, and each one of these characters trumps the other characters. Mm-hmm. And the sense that they
so it's hierarchy.
Yeah, it's a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And up to the end, the last one being the 21st card, which is the universe or the world.
So is that not really how it's looked at today, is it? That there's a hierarchy in the major arcana?
Yeah.
Really?
There is. It's, mm-hmm. I think it's seen as a progression, uh-huh, rather than as a hierarchy per se. But in terms of if you're playing the game Tarot and mm-hmm, or Tarot Chi, and there's a variety of ways to play it. You play the game pretty much as a game where you know, your numbers, your higher numbers trump your lower numbers. Now there's some very
A Tarot game.
Yeah, there's a game of Tarot. Yeah, well, we don't play it much here, but right, it's available. There's, if you look for it, there's actually an online version of it now that you can, uh-huh, play on the internet, which I play all the time as a kind of solitaire.
Uh-huh. I'm going to have to check that out.
And
if I just look up Game Tarot or Tarot Game, it'll come up.
Yeah, yeah, and locally. It's in French, but and uh-huh, I've never been able to quite read the rules. That's probably why though I play it all the time, I almost never win, probably because I don't know what I'm doing. But the in some of the rules, the rules vary a lot actually. But in some, for instance, the feminine cards are trump in the opposite direction. In other words, the 10 is low. And the ace is high, and then it, but the, for the masculine cards, which are the wands, it's the opposite. Uh-huh. Now that's way too confusing for uh-huh, me to, uh-huh, to follow.
Right.
I mean, I'm glad that most of the games. I mean, I thought I'm never going to get that straight. Uh-huh. You know, uh-huh, I was going to drive myself crazy. But the
use of the tarot in the past
in divination, it's a relatively recent phenomenon.
Using it as divination.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Because now, I come across many things today where they're talking about the tarot as in a psychological framework of using the tarot to know yourself better.
Yeah, yeah. And how this evolved is a tremendously interesting story in itself. It actually, it begins with the development of the tarot. The mm-hmm, tarot in itself and the triumphs mm-hmm, do have, you know, some meaning to remnants of pagan mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And a medieval social order.
Well, I think of the, you know, you still have your four suits.
We're looking at the trumps. I was thinking specifically of the trumps now, which are the 22 major arcana. That is, with the addition of the extra court card, mm-hmm, is what is different about the tarot, is that you have these major arcana.
Right.
Now, the major arcana then are interpreted in a special way. They represent, major life changes, initiations, mm-hmm, et cetera. So when they come up in a card, the regular cards will constellate around whatever the major arcana are, if there are major arcana that occur in a reading.
So they more or less would represent more abstract or metaphysical or archetypal.
Yes.
Type
yes.
of.
And
that's, you know, because I've got this little book here.
Jung and the Tarot.
The handbook of the Jungian Tarot and the use of archetypes.
Yeah, well, that's Robert Wang's book. And he actually did a thing called the Jungian Tarot. Mm-hmm. And it's specifically, Carl Jung mentions the Tarot mm-hmm, and even gives a rundown of the meaning of the trumps.
Right. Right,
it was available in manuscript, in the New York Jungian Society, mm-hmm, and was translated recently.
Well, it's actually, I think that's what this is in here. And one of the things about in the introduction, again, as I did last week, I wonder about the psychology of the person who's doing the writing, and I wonder a little bit about Carl Jung, in that he has, I'm probably not going to find the right page here immediately, but, Female is shown, among other aspects, as maiden, as mother, as grandmother, as whore. Man is seen as young boy, as father, as grandfather. And I thought, okay, where is man as the counterpart of the whore? And I was just, man
that's
is...
That's the page.
That's the page?
That's the page. that's the young man who is obviously has no sexual scruples.
Exactly. So I was thinking, okay, we've got the whore, then maybe we've got the rapist.
Yes. And in fact, probably the Page of Swords could very easily be a rapist.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Or somebody who's self-justifying themselves, right. Would self-justify their thing.
But again, it's interesting in talking about Jung and archetypes, and again, I'm just going to jump back here. The Wicked Witch may, for example, be considered as a destructive aspect of the mother, shown as the moon, and the wise old man, the grandfather,
the
as
cynics,
teacher.
Yeah.
So you've got a wicked witch and you've got a wise old man. So I think.
Yeah.
That's
well,
a
you
bit
can
slanted.
Also, but you can also have the cynics as the trickster.
The
old man who is deliberately misleading.
Right.
The miser, the mm-hmm. miser old man mm-hmm. would be right. probably the classic version of the old man. Guarding his patrimony rather
uh-huh.
than. Then putting it out so it'll grow.
Mm-hmm.
And
but again, it's ways that we as human beings try to translate our experience in this rather undefined world.
and this is, I mean, there's a beauty. The beauty of the tarot deck then is that you have, you can say that it comes in four parts. Mm-hmm. You have the four suits,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes they're called the pips.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, ace through 10,
mm-hmm.
and they're numbered, right? And then you have the 16 court cards,
mm-hmm.
again in four suits, And then you have the 22 major arcana. So mm-hmm. that's the classic structure of most tarot decks. And, I mean, there are a lot of people out there, and there are hundreds of tarot decks.
Mm-hmm.
But there are... to be conservative.
Mm-hmm.
This is a conservative reading. This is also sort of an American idiocentric reading. If I was in France, it would be different.
Mm-hmm.
If I was in Germany, it would be different.
Mm-hmm.
If I was in China or Japan, it would be different.
Mm-hmm.
But the most popular deck in both in itself and in its variations
mm-hmm.
is the Rider-Waite Coleman Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Rider was the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
A.E. Waite was a member of the Golden Dawn.
Mm-hmm.
It was an initiatory society. They had their own tarot deck,
mm-hmm.
of which very few examples exist that have been on public display,
mm-hmm.
though there are people who have done artwork to try to suggest what the deck would look like
right.
based on the written work.
Right.
Apparently there are decks around that are that people own,
mm-hmm.
but they've never published them, so we don't know exactly what
right.
these archetypal decks go back. These go back to about the 1880s
mm-hmm.
at the earliest, and they were handmade because they weren't being printed at that time.
Mm-hmm.
After leaving the Golden Dawn, he founded his own society, and he
mm-hmm.
actually converted to Catholicism, which was sort of de rigueur at this
mm-hmm.
period of time in the 1880s through
mm-hmm.
the early period just before World War I and after of becoming to Catholicism. And he wrote a great deal on esoteric topics. I
mm-hmm.
mean, Waite was actually sort of kind of the way he made his living. Well, he designed, commissioned another member of the Golden Dawn who was also a theater artist.
Mm-hmm.
And her name was Coleman Smith,
mm-hmm.
Pixie Coleman Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes say Trixie, but that's my mind playing
uh-huh.
this. Pixie Coleman Smith. And she was an art, her arts, well, she and the only work that's really she's really known for, though she did illustrate books and a few things.
Mm-hmm.
She always had a hard time making a living,
mm-hmm.
which seems to be true for people interested in this kind of work.
Right.
It's not everybody, but a lot of us tend to be all, you know, hardly make
make ends meet.
Hand to foot and mouth or whatever. But the so her work that's best known, and, but it's mostly posthumous, is the illustration work that she did. Now, it's really obvious that in Waite's deck that he had a great deal of input about the major arcana.
Mm-hmm.
And however, we don't know. There's not a lot of evidence that he cared too much about what the minor arcana is, the minor arcana being the court cards and the pips, as mm-hmm. we said before. Mm-hmm. And the what she did, and this was the great innovation of Pixie Coleman Smith, mm-hmm. is what she did is she added images and little story images to mm-hmm. all of the cards, mm-hmm. which makes them much more readable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And though there's a great deal of esoteric symbology packed away in all the cards,
right.
the ones that have the deepest symbology as far as the esoteric stuff is, was that Waite was familiar with, mm-hmm. he reserved primarily, and this goes along with the European tradition, for the major arcana,
mm-hmm.
you know, for these big spiritual initiatory cards.
Right.
And he wasn't as concerned for the meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And his book on the thing, which I think Mary Greer, who's one of the great scholars of Mary Greer, G-R-E-E-R. She has a blog, by the way. If you go Mary K. Greer blog and you put that in a Google, you will find that she has a wonderful blog that includes lots of wonderful insights into the history of the tarot, and a lot of, some of the things that I'm talking about I've
right.
gotten from reading through her blog.
Mm-hmm.
She's definitely one of the preeminent historians and interpreters of mm-hmm. the tarot. Another woman who's also important and the, also for the writer Waite deck is Rachel Pollack.
Mm-hmm.
And her book that's specifically geared towards understanding the Rider Waite deck is The 78 Degrees of Wisdom, a book of tarot, by mm-hmm. Which has recently been reissued by Weiser.
Mm-hmm.
Both of these women do a wonderful job in introducing people to the meaning of the cards as traditionally mm-hmm. understood, mm-hmm. as historically evolved. Now, The question comes to mind is, as we're saying about Pixie Smith, is she added all these wonderful images to mm-hmm. this, to these cards, to the minor arcana. Of course, I'm immediately looking at my deck and I can't find any minor arcana. I'm just finding, here we go. For instance, in the Seven of Cups, there is this very profound, in fact, at the workshop I went to, this thing, there was a one of the workshops was specifically dealing just with this one card, the Seven of Cups, and you'll see that there's a man, and mm-hmm. he's the shadow of a man or a woman, who is looking upon seven cups,
mm-hmm.
all of whom have different things coming out of them in the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like and each one of these has an object. And what it is it's basically recounting a fable. The fable exactly, I'd have to refer to my notes mm-hmm. to say what any of this is again. But in one, there's a wreath, and if you look deeply, you'll see that there's a skull in the cup itself. And then,
so if you were coming across this card in a reading,
yeah.
or if you just were deciding to pull a card and take a look at it, what would this be telling you? Because one of the things is, in looking through different tarot books and talking about pulling a card,
mm-hmm.
Is to look at this in a very subjective fashion.
Right.
As to what does it mean to you. So I would look at the Seven of Cups, or as a person looking at this array of possibilities, as being one, you're faced with a magnitude of choices.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at that as to, okay, what do each one of these things represent to you as an individual, each of the items in there? And it's being that it's cups, it's more in the emotional realm, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Because we talk about in the minor arcana that you've got your four suits, and I'm just going to read this, and this is from Existential Time Limited Therapy.
Okay.
Which is Freddie Strasser, who's and his daughter Strasser. They're both psychologists, psychiatrists over in the UK. And he talks about, he has made a wheel, actually.
A wheel, tarot?
No, it's not tarot. This is psychology.
Some psychologists use tarot cards.
Right. But what he talks about are the four dimensions of existence: physical, public, private, and spiritual worlds. I mean, what we're talking about, what's been represented.
There's another four, the classic four, right, of the tarot suits.
And that no human being can avoid being regulated by the physical environment and being motivated by the same principle. We are also social animals, are inevitably interacting with the world and other human beings, and I guess that would be the cups.
Mm-hmm.
Through the private or personal dimensions, we are connected with our internal world and preoccupied with our self-concept and self-worth. Now, what would that be? Would that be swords?
That could be swords, and it also could be cups, because, cups has a lot to do with emotion and with feeling and with that creativity that deals with that. But in the same way that swords has to deal with the discriminatory aspect of things, you know, so figuring out what's right or wrong, what's logical, what fits and doesn't fit.
And would you say the physical world would be coins or pentacles?
Yeah, that's usually the classic way to do it.
And then on the spiritual dimension, we connect to the world of ideas, to the metaphysical world, and to the meaning of being.
Yeah, well,
which then seems to bring in the major arcana.
Well, yeah, but the other one is that would also be wands.
Wands.
You know, which is sort of a debased way of looking at the spiritual world. Mm-hmm. You know, this is our intentions, our desires, our will, what we love in a both abstract sense. But of course, when you get to love, you're bringing in things. So the elements are intermingled.
Well, everything does intermingle.
Yes.
But, you know, if you need to just... So this you know, predates our, as I said earlier, it's pre-Freudian.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another attempt... a very early attempt or records of it to try to understand our world and how we interact with one another. And the astrology, the zodiac, is very much like that too, with your houses. And so it is a psychology of a type.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that this is very true with the way that tarot is taught now in America.
Mm-hmm.
If you became interested in tarot and you went to learn tarot, normally what people do is they look at the cards and they find the pictures interesting, and then they look in the little book, which is exactly what I've just done here. When you've asked me, you know, what the Seven of Cups means, I decided I would look in the book, but which is cheating, you know, because actually what I should do is just look at the damn card and tell you what it means. But the the way tarot is taught initially, and I think it's an important way of teaching the tarot, is we ask people to look at the card and to suppose what it means.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, just to look and say, okay, well, here's this guy or this woman who's and their hand is extended in a such a way, in a sort of way of like, in either wonder or maybe reaching out, and are looking at this array of seven cups, all of which have different things in them. And one of the things is a dragon, and one's a reef, but also in the reef is a skull, right? So that it means fame, but it also, you know, has some kind of things. And another one are jewels, and another one is a palace or things, and then there's a snake coming out of one. And then there's a woman who has a radiant veil over herself as she's emerging from the cup. And then there's this head coming out of the cup, you know, just this disembodied head, you know, smiling, but the same color as the sky, you know, not any different.
Right.
So who is it? You know, and they're all in clouds, you know, so what would that mean to me?
Right.
This is what we basically ask people. Don't look up the meaning, folk. Just imagine what it would mean.
Right.
And you're right.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
You're right. This is the beginning of how you're formulating your own symbolic vocabulary for understanding the tarot card.
Mm-hmm. How it relates to you,
mm-hmm. and how it means to you is the meaning of the card, and it's mm-hmm. the primary meaning of the card. It's not the second. You know, there is a big tradition and very self-conscious symbology involved mm-hmm. in the development of the tarot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's particularly in the Rider-Waite with the Major Arcana, because mm-hmm. that's what Waite was interested in. And as far as we know, Pixie Coleman-Smith made up these other images. Mm-hmm. But she was learned. She knew her.
Right.
She was also an initiate of the Golden
right.
Dawn. She knew her stuff. But in terms of coming up with these images, she came up with them alone.
Mm-hmm.
And the rationale has puzzled many a commentator over the years in terms mm-hmm. of where she got, mm-hmm. why she thought of doing it this way, what they mean. But this, I think, is the way tarot is taught now.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can read endless books on what the tarot cards mean. And even if they're talking about the same tradition, like they're talking about the Rider-Waite tarot,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you will discover that there are endless variations
in terms of what they
think the card means.
It makes me think again of going back to Jung.
Yeah.
Is the whole idea of, because he was very much into dream interpretation.
Right.
And the idea that there are symbols in dreams, there are pictures in dreams,
right.
and activities,
sure.
et cetera, all of which will have a particular meaning to the individual.
Right.
So you read a book on dream terminology or whatever, so if you dream about a snake, this is what it means.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you dream about a snake, maybe you were bitten by a snake when you were a child, so you would have an entirely different
idea of what a snake means. Yeah, I call that the idiolect.
Uh-huh.
You know, which is just means it's those are your personal or private associations.
Exactly.
You know,
this is how we see everything in the world is through.
Yeah,
our
we
own
have
prism.
In our languages that way. Some mm-hmm. some of our classic malpropisms or even our mm-hmm. mispronunciations of words have something to do with an idiolect.
Right.
They don't
right.
quite fit into the normal standard language.
Uh-huh.
Most people let it go.
Right. So I would say that with the tarot, it's. So how does that make it, when you are working with the tarot, if you're doing it with yourself, then you can use it for, the cards will stimulate your mind to think in certain directions.
Right.
According to your own subjective viewpoint of the world.
Right.
Now, if you're working with the tarot with another person so that you are trying to help them with the tarot, then you are asking them to bring their interpretations into it rather than...
Well, both, yeah. Usually both. Yeah,
bit of back and forth as to
what it means. So if we got the Seven of Cups and we're looking at this card and so you say, well, what does it mean? Well, let's take one glyph. This is mm-hmm. briefly, what Rachel Pollack says about the Seven of mm-hmm. Cups. And she was relating specifically to the Rider-Waite deck.
Mm-hmm.
She says, with the Seven of Cups, the problem emerges is that most direct form, emotion and imagination, can produce wonderful visions. So you see, there's cups, emotion, imagination. That's mm-hmm. what cups are. Wonderful visions, but without grounding in both action and outer realm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the pie in the sky thing.
Yeah, it's all
right?
up in the air,
it's
in
the clouds.
In the clouds, right.
But without grounding in both action and outer realities of life, these fantastic images remain deus dreams. They're fancies without real meaning or value. Notice that the visions cover a whole range of fantasies, from wealth, those are the jewels, to a victory wreath, to fear, the dragon, to adventure, the castle, to the archetype of mythology, a godlike face, that's to the radiant figure, that's the radiant, mm-hmm. mysterious figure, the snake, the universal symbol of psychic wisdom. It is a mistake to think the daydreams are meaningless because of their content. On the contrary, they are often spring the deep archetypal needs and images. They lack meaning because they do not connect with anything outside themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says reversed, which sometimes if you get the card reversed in a reading. Reversed means a determination to make something from dreams. This does not mean rejecting fantasies, but rather doing something with them.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, Rachel's reading of the reverse card is she's saying that you're really trying very much to make your dreams into reality.
Uh-huh.
Which is
rather than being a negative aspect, that's really a positive aspect.
Yeah. And the point being here, and I think that is as an initial reading of what the card means, that is a useful one. Mm-hmm. However, depending upon its context, it could mean that a person has a preference or is afraid to make a preference to various things. They're being pushed and pulled by many different types of fantasies, and they're spending too much time in the fantasy world, not dealing with the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So that in some ways their fantasies are distracting them from real life. Now, the card by itself may not suggest that. The card in the context of other cards might. So you wanted to...
I've got the Robert Wang's Tarot Psychology.
So you want to see what he has to say about the seven?
We'll see what he has to say. And this is supposedly the handbook for the Jungian Tarot.
That which is... Wang did... That's a nice tarot deck, by the way. Mm-hmm. He did his own version of it, which is slightly derivative of the Rider Waite.
Right.
Yeah.
And he says the card of obstacles, the Seven of Cups, is obstacles. Relates most commonly to personal interactions and to finances, i.e. to love and money. And when I look at this, I don't have the actual deck. I just have a picture here. It doesn't look like he's got anything coming out of the cups.
Right.
Areas in which somehow blocked can be most stressful. The activity here may be very subtle and often involves one or both parents. This is not a card of independence from home, although it may mean family strife and even a serious clash over values in which parents attempt to exercise control through finances. Now, I mean, where he's getting this is so very different from anything else. A parent may, for example, be instrumental in impeding a relationship and may do everything possible to pull a couple apart. Financial support may be withdrawn. On the other hand, a parent may be a source of needed backing. Money may appear surprisingly from one's own parents. That is, to some extent, a card of expressed needs.
So he's saying it's expressed needs.
Expressed needs.
Now, does the image on his card, his Seven of Cups, is there a person in it?
No, I don't see.
There's
one
no
person.
There's just the seven. There's just
as
the
I
cups.
Said. This picture in the book is not very clear as to what it is. But
he has usually phases of the moon, right. So it looks like it's looks like it's the dark of the moon.
Yeah, the dark of the moon. He ends it up by saying the Seven of Cups means transition.
Mm-hmm.
The goal is ultimately attained, but the overcoming of obstacles requires effort, hardship, and not infrequently sacrifice. And that little bit, without talking about the parent bit, comes to having what you were reading about all these
choices
being up in the air, and
right.
and they're not going to be materialized, not going to mean anything unless you put them into, you take some sort of action to make them happen.
Yeah.
So in coming with that, I mean, if you're going at this in a way of human psychology, this would make you think. I'm saying before you would go to your corner therapist, you know, or you go to
the tarot reader
in 1500 or something. You might go to a priest, or you would go to a tarot reader. And coming across this card, you would then relate it to your life. What are my choices? What are the possibilities? What do I have to do to make what I want real?
Right.
So it is, again, it is using psychology and
but one,
going to jump
but
into
one
this
of the things that one
internet
of the things
thing
that he that he could you could take the meditation on the meaning of the Seven of Cups.
Mm-hmm.
And you could project it into the Pixie Smith, Coleman Smith version.
Right, right.
Because there is this character who's in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
There's a shadow character.
Right.
I mean, if there isn't there are a number of shadows. That's definitely a shadow character.
Yes, absolutely.
There's no possibility of not being a shadow character.
So Jung talks about the
not
shadow
looking
side
at this,
too.
Yes. And of course, for a person dealing with obstacles or independence, mm-hmm. parents then become shadow figures. They become, you know, whether mm-hmm. particularly if you're in a young adult,
right?
Then your parents attempting to control you, own mm-hmm. you, give you an allowance or otherwise, so forth and so on. And you know, you yourself have been a daughter and have been a mother, so you know this. You know,
well, I need this whole thing where kids reach a stage where they want all the privileges of the kids and all the privileges of an adult at the same time. It doesn't
work.
Yes,
they want all the privileges and none of the responsibilities.
Exactly.
And of course, the responsibilities, coming from the point of view of just the kid wanting only the candy and not the and not the dental bills,
right? Exactly.
Is definitely the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, responsibilities, folks, don't have to be shadows.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were a Seven of Cups dilemma, it's probably, that the real world in some ways seems burdensome, as mm-hmm. would the parental obligations seem burdensome. Mm-hmm. You know, as he also talks a great deal about money there mm-hmm. and things like that.
Right.
Well, again, money normally is a
key
a pentacle
freedom.
Issue, mm-hmm. you know, it's, or, you know, money is an issue of that deals with work, you mm-hmm. know, it deals with how you make your livelihood in the world, you know. You know, in the same way that the wands generally mean, represent, you know, how you get energized,
mm-hmm.
what turns you on,
interest,
what wakes
excitement.
You up, interest, yes, you know, it's how, you know, so, you know, it's lighting my fire, right?
Uh-huh.
It's getting me going, it's
uh-huh.
creating, it's my desire,
uh-huh.
you know. You know, like, well, let's
and then just, the swords. Tell me what the swords are. Again.
And the swords. Well, the swords are the classic discrimination. They're thinking.
Uh-huh. Right.
They're thinking both in a delusive sense. In other words, a double-edged sword cuts both ways.
Right.
It can both, you know, give you a discrimination, so you can divide the real from the false.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and it can also self-delude you so that you can't tell the difference between the real and false.
Mm-hmm.
You can be cut both ways with it.
Mm-hmm.
And because of this discriminatory aspect, the swords can be most revealing in terms of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, the understanding can lead you into a variety of very self-delusive and self-deluding situations.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, thinking is, you know, as a friend of mine used to say, you can get more stinking from thinking than you can from drinking. But the feel is for real.
Uh-huh.
And, uh-huh. And of course, you can see this guy must have been a cups person,
yes,
right? Because he was really into, or as he said, he was down on drinking, but, you know, he says you get more stinking from thinking than you can from drinking.
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
But he definitely thought that feeling was where it was at.
Right. Well,
and
if we get from going back to last week with affect
right.
being reaction and then feeling and then you think.
Right.
That's the stimulus, and the stimulus from thought, then you come to being conscious of the fact that you are thinking.
Yeah, yeah. But thinking, there's a confusion, and it's a confusion that the Germans particularly have been fun to think is this, as far as they're concerned, you can't be conscious that you're thinking unless you're thinking.
Uh-huh.
In other words, so thinking is the manifest object of awareness.
Uh-huh.
And without that manifest object, you're not aware.
So I said, one of the things I said last week was, instead of I think, therefore I am, it's I am, therefore I think.
Yeah. And I think one of the things we're going to explore maybe in the next show that
mm-hmm.
we'll do is we're going to do a show. I'm going to see if we can get the author on the show, see if we can get him to call in.
That'd be great.
Yeah. What we'll do is we're going to talk about a version of awareness without an object. You know, awareness without the stimulus thinking. Can you be aware without thinking? Is there a non-thinking awareness, a non-feeling awareness?
Uh-huh.
Is there an awareness of awareness? You know,
right.
and there's a classic trope that's used in Buddhism, which says the sword can't cut itself.
Uh huh.
See.
Okay.
And meaning that awareness of awareness is impossible.
Uh-huh.
Was what they were trying to say with that trope. in the classic, this is from the Lenka Vatara Sutra for you Buddhists out there. But
what I want to jump in and say to people who are listening is that we're going to have a series of conversations here at the Counselor's Cafe, all dealing about the nature of existence, our relationship to it, and again, it's psychology, it's philosophy, and it's a little bit of something else. And Paul has been great enough to say he'd come in and help me explore this entire realm here on the Counselor's Cafe as it reflects psychology and philosophy. So thanks, Paul. This is going to be good.
Yeah. And what we'll do is we'll also bring in you know, external sources of various writers and readings. And if we can get the writers to call in on the show, all the better. So I'm going to actually call the publicist for Sounds True and see if we can get that writer to call in. Yeah, I know he'll be happy to have his book reviewed. It's no longer on the, it's now part of the backlist. It takes me forever to get around to looking at these things. But this idea of consciousness in some ways this is also this kind of awareness of awareness is sort of one vibrant way showing or trying to show what the nature of what's called detachment. Now, it's not detachment in the sense that you don't feel something. It's that you can feel and feel deeply, you know, even to where the sense of you will feel the pain and feel the discomfort or feel the joy, but you would not be reactivity to it, as you not be caught in it like a snare, but somehow stay non-reactive to it.
That's very much what Viktor Frankl, an existential psychotherapy, is involved with. And we talk about therapy, and I want to touch very briefly on the thread that you clued me into about Thoreau as therapy and the problems that they're running into.
Right.
Because, as you mentioned earlier, people, if you're talking with someone, if you've got a deck in front of you and you're putting cards out and you're encouraging other people to interpret them and you are giving your thoughts as well, then is this therapy or counseling? And if so, then how does it interact with people who have been trained in today's what you might call our modern mysticism, and that is psychology and not philosophy, but psychiatry. And there being an ongoing question as to are there legal aspects involved with someone who is offers themselves as a Thoreau reader, where you cannot, it seems, at any way, shape, or form, intimate that you're giving therapy?
No, actually, I mean, because you know, the hounds of the establishment will shoot you down and get you tossed into prison using the fortune teller laws. But the thing is that you basically have to say that, you know, if you're going to get a tarot reading, it's for entertainment purposes.
Yes, yes.
Now, you can be, there's no reason that you can't be serious about your entertainment.
Exactly. There's no reason why you can't pick this up yourself.
And in summary,
all the 9 million self-help books out there, you might as well.
Yeah, and but also, also part of the fun of tarot is sharing it with other people. Mm-hmm. And this is sharing, learning how to do the readings and what the cards mean. Now, and then, of course, the question is, you've got 78 cards, and those are like 78 possibilities. And if you have an issue that's bothering you, and you take those and you shuffle through the cards, and you pull out one or two or three or four or 10 or whatever cards, and you look at them, it's going to have something to say about whatever your needs are. Just because there's so many different possibilities available.
Well, how many times have you heard today about people who, and I'm not going to mention a particular book, but people who will say when they're looking for inspiration, they open a book.
Right.
And they read whatever their eye falls on.
Yeah,
and
a little
they
bibliomancy.
Take that,
yeah.
As a clue for their activities for the future. Anyway, we're getting pretty close to the end, and we should be following up. Tobin Logan should be coming in to do his reading. And come back next week when Paul and I will be talking about, tell us.
We'll be talking about objectless awareness, non-reactivity awareness. I forget exactly what the phrase
being
is.
Being aware that you're aware.
Yeah, being aware that you're aware. And there's a nice book out that's what we will feature next time. And if possible, we will see if we can get the author to call in and join us in discussion with about the book.
Terrific. Thanks, Paul. Stay tuned now. WCOM LP, Chapel Hill, Carrboro, 103.5 FM. And come back next week.